Today's lecture is a continuation of yesterday's lecture. Yesterday, we described how to actually solve a hyperbolic equation. I chose the wave equation as an example, and I wrote some code. We wrote some code together in a notebook that so far only provides the infrastructure for solving the wave equation. Just to not to be too confusing, I'm going to recap some things of the blackboard. So the equation that we're solving is the wave equation. And the wave equation is dt squared u equals dx squared u. You're going to solve the wave equation on a two-dimensional grid. It's a partial differential equation, the hyperbolic equation. And the grid has a t direction and an x direction. Let me just sketch the grid here again. That would be the x direction. That would be the t direction. And then we have some grid points here. I'm not going to draw too many grid points. And for this hyperbolic equation, we are going to have to provide initial conditions and boundary conditions and then solve it in the interior. Boundary condition. Sorry, let me hunt for some colors. Yes, I used orange yesterday. Okay, it's going to be red today. We're going to provide initial conditions here at the initial time. And since it's an equation that is second order in time, you need to provide two initial conditions, either conditions for u and u dot. Here we're going to do something similar. We're going to provide initial conditions for the first two points in time. And we're going to provide boundary conditions at the boundary points, left and right. And you see that overlap here. That is a consistency condition that you need to satisfy. The initial conditions and the boundary conditions need to be compatible with each other. And that is that. And then we had a finite differencing stencil that we set up. And the idea was we take the spatial derivatives via finite differencing via three-point stencil. And we also formally write down the time derivative via the same stencil, except in time. And then we place the stencil very conveniently in here, that the stencil extends here. Let me draw the next row of points here. And then every time we apply the stencil, we know the 3 points of the current time and 1 point of the past time. And then we can calculate this point here in the future time. And with two rows of initial conditions, we can fill in all the points of the next row except the boundary condition and then move from past to the future until we solve the wave equation everywhere. And I'm going to briefly recap the code we wrote last time. I made some small changes under the hood. There is one function, coordinates, that sets up the coordinates. Let me add comments.
By the way, this file is in SciPortal.
Thank you. So a function that lives on these grid points is sometimes called a grid function. It's a weird term, but it just means the function has been discretized on a grid. Define two grid functions. They're called t and x, holding the coordinates. This is this here. I choose a resolution of 100 grid points. The domain here is 0 to 1 implicitly in all directions. And this here, define initial conditions for a standing wave. So a standing wave just oscillates in place. You have seen that. And we set up this. And then we plotted this. And the result looks like this. The result looks pretty boring most of the future because we haven't calculated anything there. We just see the initial condition, the tiny sliver here, which is the wave equation. And after this recap, now let's begin to write the function that fills in the remainder of the grid. Yesterday, I applied boundary conditions at the same time as the initial conditions. That was a bit awkward. I took that out. Yesterday, I had inconvenience here where I transposed x, t, and u before turning it into 1D vectors. I took that out as well. Do you recall why this function vec here is necessary when we plot it? OK. So the visualization function expects 1D arrays. You have XT and U as 2D arrays, and this just flattens it out. It kind of lays it out in one 1D array. It's a very efficient function because it doesn't change the memory layout, I assume. Okay, so let's define a function that calculates a new solution at one point here. Let's call it evolve point. So as input, okay, I'm going to add an exclamation mark because this function is actually going to modify the solution array. It's going to, well, going to fill in one of the uninitialized points. So the solution array is U. And we also need dt and dx, sorry. First, I'm getting the size of the array U. And the convention that I'm choosing here, since U is a 2D array, that the first direction is the X direction and the second dimension is the T dimension. You can choose it differently as well, but you need to be consistent everywhere. Oh, and this evolve point should also do it at one particular point. Let's pass in N and I. And this will evolve point, sulfur point. Anyway, function name does not matter. This function will calculate the new solution at that point, which requires us to invert the stencil that I haven't written down yet. Let me write down the finite differencing stencil here. This is the second derivative. Call it f double prime. Let's write it down only as in the stencil point at I. For finite differencing is defined as f at I minus 1 minus 2 f at I plus f at index I plus 1 divided by h squared. And we can do that in both the time and the space direction. And it's going to be a bit complicated. And I'm going to do some equation manipulation here on the screen, not on the blackboard. Because that might be easier. We can rearrange terms. You don't have to type as much. So let's assume we have u. Then we want to calculate the second time derivative u. Call this, say, uxx. And at one particular point, x came first, right? I comma n equals, that's u at I minus 1 comma n. So I'm taking the spatial derivative. The time index n, I'm just going to carry that around here. Nothing happens here. Minus 2 times u of I comma n plus u of I plus 1 comma n. Big parenthesis divided by dx squared. Do you all see this? Does this equation make sense? Now, since we want to calculate it at this point here, we actually need the second space derivative, not at n, but at one point earlier in time. So we're going to have to update this. Oh, I don't know whether I should. So this is the point where you want to calculate something. And this has the coordinates I and n. So this would be n minus 1, n minus 2, I plus 1, I minus 1. So since this is at time n minus 1, I'm going to change. Oh, no, sorry. This does not look like that. I don't have an array for uxx. I'm going to write n minus 1 everywhere here. Okay, you're all suspicious. I hope you're holding on and I'm not losing you. I know in the beginning, the lecture room was filled with 300 people. By now, there's about 8 people left. I can't afford to lose any more people. Then with the third to last lecture, please hold on. Please stop me and ask questions. Now, let's formally also calculate the second time derivative. This will not be useful. We are going to rearrange the equation. Then we have UTT equals U of, and I'm writing it for this one here. So this is n minus 1, n minus 2. So we have to be a bit careful because I write I, not n. We are applying it to time now. And this is I minus 1 to I plus 2. We are applying it to n minus 2 to n. So we need to add 1, subtract 1 to the indices here. I hope that's not confusing, not too confusing. So that should make sense, apart from indexing errors. And you tell me if there's anything wrong. Now we want the solution at one interior point, ui, n. Sorry, I'm scrolling up. I just want to make sure that, I'm consistent with my indices, because when I pass it function values, I have time and space for and I. But in the array, we have space and then time. I chose the different order for the functions and for the array. Sorry for that. It just makes it confusing. And of course, if you call this function and you mix up n and I indices, you're not going to get an error message. It's just going to be really weird. So you have to be careful here. Okay, so we want the solution at this point. So now, also we have the wave equation, okay? And the wave equation says that UTT is equals to UXX. And the problem is, of course, we don't know this point here, this value here. That's the one we want to calculate. So now we have to solve for this value here and rearrange everything instead of calculating in that way. We want to calculate it such that these equations hold. So these are all going to be comments in the end. But we're, and then u of I comma n equals, and then how does this go? We have on the left-hand side UTT, which is UXX, which we calculated. So this is UXX. Then we multiply both sides with dt squared. And then we subtract this value, I guess, and we add the other value. And that might be it, right? Wrong? Any complaints? You're still thinking? This is very suspicious. No syntax errors. That's good.
Why the... okay.
Yes, ask the question. If you have that question, others probably do.
I thought you... Oh, yeah. Why UXX times dt squared? Is UTT?
These are the definitions of the second derivatives, UTT and UXX. And the wave equation says these are equal. So we start with calculating UXX, which we can do. And then UTT is equal to that. So this is going to be the left-hand side. That is the right-hand side if we swap it around. And this is just pulling out the term from the thing above there. It's on one hand straightforward algebra, but it can be quite confusing. And if you get the indices wrong, then of course this will be difficult to debug. And it's also difficult to test that on its own. So now let's write another evolve function that calls this function for all of the points in the interior. okay, let's do it. Let's call it for one instance in time so that we can actually advance in time. Call it step. And I'm only passing n in because I'm going to have a loop over I. And now comes the problem with the boundary condition. If I want to find the solution everywhere, I can't do it at the boundary. So at the boundary, I am going to have to fill in the boundary condition. And I'm going to choose a very simple boundary condition, Dirichlet boundary condition, where I set everything to zero. This is u of 1 comma n equals 0. Looping over all the points. Doing that is actually easy because we just wrote the function. Need to pass in all the stuff. And we need to apply the other boundary condition. Sorry. Checking for syntax errors. Very good. We agree that that function makes sense. I'm mostly hoping here for you to tell me if we get any indices wrong, because I might not spot that.
You gonna return u for these?
It would be more elegant if these were functions that return the solution. But for efficiency, it's much better if you pre-allocate the full array and then just write to individual array elements. The code is much less elegant, but if you want to do anything in real numerical methods, you have to do mutating methods like that. And you still mentally, it's still a function. Because each array element is set only once. You don't want to set it twice or doing something weird like that. But unfortunately, it doesn't look like a mathematical function. And that's why I use these exclamation marks there as warning to the reader. The exclamation mark is just a warning. It's part of the function name. It's just a convention. That this will actually change u, the first argument, will update it with a solution. Now I don't pass n because I'm going to do it everywhere. Now we loop over all times for n in 3 to nn. Look at the loop over the x direction. We start at 2, we leave out the leftmost point, and we end at ni minus 1, we leave out the rightmost point. But here when we evolve in time, you go from the third point all the way to the final point because you have two initial conditions and no final condition. And if you just return, nothing happens. Okay, that function looks straightforward. I think you all understand it. Let's see what happens if we call it. Okay. I'm passing in the t and the x and so on everywhere. I should have defined them as constants here. I'm just making the beginning more elegant. If I were to write this in a real way, then I would probably find some kind of environment object, a single object that holds all this configuration data, the NI and NDT and DX, and I would define that at some point and pass that around. Or if you use an object-oriented programming style, then all the methods are part of that object and they see these variables anywhere. And then you don't need to pass around all these individual bits and pieces. But here, on this kind of interactive programming, where I kind of I discover parts of how to write that as we do it together, then it doesn't look as elegant. So that should not have changed T or X or anything, the solution. Let's call it. And what do I pass in? I think just the T and the X. And then I'm going to plot the solution again. I'll copy that here. And yesterday I used 4 or 5 points because that's nice in the beginning when you just call the functions for the first time and do something. Now I'm using 100 points. Now I'm looking for something that looks much nicer. Ooh, now, nice. Is that actually correct? This does not look correct. It looks beautiful though. So, as we discovered yesterday, yellow is where the function is 1, and dark blue is where the function is -1, and green is where it's 0. So at the left and right boundaries, I apply the boundary conditions, I set everything to 0, the function should be 0 there. That looks good, but the initial condition does not look right, because at the initial point, I already expect a wave there, and that's not the case. Mm. So I'm going to have to scroll through that and see what is wrong with the code. You know what, maybe I should just rerun the notebook. That's often a good idea. Happened here. Everything is white. Okay, we come back. It's loading CairoMark here. By the way, Julia 1.9 has not been released yet. So that speed up is not there yet. Okay, anyway, this solves the wave equation. What we can do later on is solve the wave equation at different resolutions, look at convergence, see whether it converges to the right solution. And we can also play with initial conditions to get a bit of a feeling what it means to have a characteristic mode there. It's a PDE, so technically you're only allowed to put in smooth twice differentiable functions. But the discrete code that we wrote is actually well posed also for other things. So you can have a condition, initial condition that is zero everywhere, and at one point it has a spike. It doesn't matter how large the spike is, because the function is linear, you can always scale by anything, set the spike to 1, and then you see how that propagates to the domain. Now, kind of putting a delta function, here a delta function as initial condition has a really weird solution. So I'm not even sure it converges. It has a continuum limit. I don't see that. But you see properties of the code. For example, how fast thing propagates. And oh, and I should have mentioned that earlier. There's this term of conditionally stable. There is a condition on the time step size related to the spatial step size. And we could take our time evolution method and put a wave in there and see what happens under what conditions is stable or not. It's a bit involved, but you can at least experiment numerically with it. You can have dt equals dx, dt 1/2 dx, or you can set dt to 1.5 dx and see what happens to the solution. Sorry. It did not change. Oh, man. Okay. Who can find the bug?
Sorry, what is U? Oh, okay.
No, no, ask, ask. Please help me here, I'm stuck.
My function was wrong.
Yeah, mine is also wrong. That's the problem here.
Can I see evolve again?
Okay, that's the first evolve?
No, the last, it's just evolve.
The last evolve, okay. This loops over all times. It assumes we have initial condition at times 1 and 2, and then evolves it for all the other times. And this loop here needs to be executed in that order. We need to go from the past to the future in the right order. Otherwise, you would access undefined points. The other loop up here in the interior, that we can do in any order. Because we are calculating this point from points we know. It doesn't matter in what order we evolve these points. So in principle, we can parallelize the code in this direction here.
I set cos to sine and sine to cos in the boundary conditions, and then
okay.
Get something that looks like what you're looking for, I think.
Really? The boundary condition is wrong? Ah, oh, okay. So in my initial condition.
Because it's at t equals 0, so. Oh no. Yeah, so it'll be cons. That'll be cons.
So for my analytic solution, I want something that is zero at the outer boundary. And if I set x to zero, the sine is zero. And if I set x to one, the sine is also zero.
Right. So, but...
Are the coordinates wrong?
Yeah, I don't know. I was confused as to when we were using I and m for t and x. But I don't know. Like if you just scroll down and swap, sine for cos, yeah, and then run it and you'll see, I think what you're expecting.
Yeah, yeah, I do get. Okay, that means the code probably swapped indices I and n in some point. Oh, maybe it's even the definition of the coordinates here. You know what? Let me plot the coordinates here and see how they look like, whether the coordinates look how I think they should look like. This is the x coordinate, that's correct. And this is the time coordinate, and that's also correct. Okay. Okay, now we get the solution here, but it used to be the initial condition. Okay. Okay, I'm going to spend 2 minutes trying to debug this because this is embarrassing. And otherwise, I'm going to move on, assuming the code was correct. Aha, found it. Okay, since you're only plotting the initial condition here, I'm only going to plot the initial condition here. Of course, it's much smaller now. And then we have the final solution here, which is the wave equation. And you see that the solution is not perfect. It looks a bit skewed, looks a bit weird. And that is, of course, that because we only solve it with 100 points, it's not actually fully accurate. Okay, I'm going to run the code again with a higher resolution, and then we can put the low and the higher resolution next to each other. I need to scroll a bit to find the corresponding function calls, because first I need to get some coordinates for the higher resolution. Let's call it t1 and x1. And then I need to get a u1 from the initial conditions. And then I'm evolving that. user interface is frozen again. I'm using 1 because this is now essentially level 1. DT1 not defined. Or is DT over 2? And then I'm going to plot the higher resolution. I should not have started with 100. Yeah, let's try to put it into the same plot. This is arcs 1,1. I hope it works like that.
Maybe you have to call axis on, like, axis of fake 1,1, and then axis of fake 1,2. Like, you have to create an axis object for them.
No, I don't. Sorry, confusing myself here. I'm going to get out of that. I don't want to debug the plotting a figure here. You see that the higher resolution, it looks better than in the lower resolution in some way, but who knows what is this here. Ah, no, let's plot the error. So I'm taking the solution. This is currently busy. So I'm going to scroll up to get an equation, an expression for the analytic solution. And I plot u minus the analytic solution. Now I need to use the dot notation here. This does not look fine, does it? Does not look fine. This looks really weird. This looks really weird. I do not understand this. Apologies again. Do you spot the bug here? I'm sorry for holding you up like this, but on the other hand, this is, of course, real life. I'll check my evolution function. Maybe there is a bug. I minus 1, I plus 1. Go to I minus 1, 3 to n. Okay. Well, that kind of makes the next step of this planned lecture moot. So this is going to be the tutorial tomorrow afternoon. Sorry about that. Namely, do a convergence test. Of course, we have to debug this function, and I can do that offline. I can tell you what the bug is. And then on Friday afternoon, together, we can do a convergence test with that. What I wanted to show here is different solutions and see how the solution looks like, show how the error looks like. But apparently, that's not possible here, unless we find the bug in the next few minutes. The second half of the lecture is then about elliptic equations and how to solve elliptic equations, the wave equation is an example for a hyperbolic equation. Elliptic equations need to be solved slightly differently, and you usually do not, you cannot get that much into detail writing a code like this. So the disadvantage of solving a hyperbolic equation like this, that you have to write a lot of code, not just the initial and boundary condition, but also the stencils and looping over the arrays and the grid functions and modifying points and so on. It's quite low level. When you solve elliptic equations, the standard of software engineering and math is slightly differently. It's usually done at a higher level, but it's also slower just because elliptic equations are more complicated. So I'm going to, I don't know, spend 2 minutes here asking you whether you have questions, comments, and so on. And then I'm going to switch on to a different topic, elliptic equations, slightly related, but I'm going to introduce a different method.
You should run the same like initial conditions as we started with, but with cos and cos. It looks cool.
Okay. So if you,
so like the ones that we did with like the binary one, just
yes,
instead of cos and sine, do cos cos.
Yes. So what then happens then is that the boundary condition is zero. Your initial condition is one at the boundary. So right here you get Heaviside function, a step function at the boundary. And that probably does not converge to something really nicely, but it does look cool. It does converge?
Well, it looks cool, definitely.
Yes, it does look cool. So you see a step function, and that probably propagates in 45 degrees here. Yes. It's similar to what I suggested, where you set everything to zero and set one of these to one, and then you see what happens.
It's good for everyone.
Really weird. Okay, so this looks as if, yes, nice. This plot that I'm getting looks as if everything here in the lower triangle is zero and everything up there is non-zero. And I don't know how that comes from the equation that I typed in here. I assume it's a bug somehow in that gray code here, but I currently don't see where that bug would come from. So I'm going to leave it at that. Okay, very good. Let's move on to another notebook here. And then it's going to be a bit of a theoretical section on elliptic equations. Let's move to the other end of the blackboard. So, elliptic equations. Name an elliptic equation.
Laplace.
Thank you. Name one that is more complicated.
Poisson.
Thank you. You can read. We're going to solve the Poisson equation. apart from the names of the coordinates, which of course are completely irrelevant, the Laplace equation looks very similar to the wave equation. It's just different by a minus sign. So we have dx squared plus dy squared u equals some right-hand side rho that is given. And for the wave equation, there's a minus sign here. Here there is no minus sign here. You can look at these terms here as saying u is a scalar. You take the gradient, and then you take the divergence. If you do this in Cartesian coordinates, you get this. If you do this in a Minkowski spacetime with a metric that has a minus one sign, you get that over there. And of course, you can do this with other operators. It doesn't need to be just the identity matrix. Any symmetric positive operator would serve as a metric here. And these operators are sometimes also called elliptic operators, because if you have some kind of potential where the height lines are ellipses, then you get an elliptic operator that would that thing with positive definite eigenvalues. And if that operator has one negative eigenvalue, then the equipotential surfaces look like saddle points, look like a saddle, and that's then called a hyperbolic. So this is where the names come from, elliptic and hyperbolic. And unfortunately, they have very different properties if you want to solve them. And one large difference is that for hyperbolic equations, if you give initial conditions, this is stable, you can evolve them in the future, even without boundary conditions. Oh, I should have sketched it earlier. This is now something about analytic, nothing with the discretization. If you have a hyperbolic equation, say the wave equation, and you specify some initial condition or two initial conditions on a hypersurface, you're in 2D and 1D, for example, on a surface like this, then this completely specifies the solution in the domain of dependence of the surface. You're probably familiar with light cones. You have one point, and then you see what is influenced by this point. Now we are asking the converse question. Which region of space-time is defined only depends on the surface? Only depends on data on the surface and nothing else. It also depends on the light cone, but it looks a bit different. So this would be that region here, and that is the domain of dependence. So if you specify initial conditions here, you can solve the wave equation in the kind of future light pyramid. It's not a light cone here. And you can also go backwards in time, actually, because it's time symmetric. You could also do that. And then now if you have this and then you apply boundary conditions as well, then of course you can also fill this in here and then you go until here. And I drew myself into a corner here. And ultimately, you could even go here into the future. So if you spay initial conditions here and boundary conditions here, then finally you can solve the wave equation everywhere. So even if you stop applying boundary condition, you can still go a bit into the future into the domain of dependence there. And there's no magic here. If you understand how causality works in special relativity, that's exactly what comes out here. Here for the wave equation, I assume it's a light cone. For other equations, if you have a scalar wave, say acoustic waves in the room, it's the sound cone. And if you have systems of equations, then different combinations of variables, different characteristic modes, move at different speeds. And then, of course, it's the kind of the fastest speed that limits what would happen there. But the picture always looks approximately like that. Now, for an elliptic equation, it is very different. There are no characteristics. If you specify a solution just on one line, there's nothing you can do. Even if you have, say, two initial conditions here, and you try to calculate what happens away from it, you get unstable mode that grow exponentially, and there's no way to fix that. Now, you did something really bad in your equation, and what happened was not unstable. You got essentially wiggles, something propagating. There was probably something highly oscillatory. So if you have a perturbation of the system for a hyperbolic equation, it's just going to propagate, but it's not going to grow exponentially. Because of that minus sign here, it grows exponentially. And the only way to do something with elliptic equations to completely enclose your domain in boundary conditions, anything that would go unstable and start to grow gets then clamped down by the boundary condition on the other side. And then you can solve it in the interior. And you do it numerically, it might be a square, might be a box or something, but it's not possible to have any opening like that. It needs to be closed everywhere to be stable. And that we know from the continuum, of course, in the discrete, exactly the same thing. It's a bit more funny if you have a closed domain. For example, you want to solve an elliptic equation on the surface of a sphere. There, of course, there is no boundary. So you can, in principle, do that. But there's still a bit of a problem. And that you can also see here. So let's write it slightly differently here. We have Laplace u equals rho. U is the solution. Rho is given. And this is the Laplace operator. It's a linear operator. So and U is a function. Function spaces are vector spaces. We discretize it. So in principle, you can write this at AX equals B. And then you ask yourself, why can't we solve this system? why do we need something else? Can you see what's going wrong here? Why we can't just solve the system? Why we can't just say U equals Laplace inverse applied to rho?
The Laplacian sends all of the harmonic functions to zero, so you can't use the information.
Yes, the Laplace operator is not positive. It has zero eigenvalues. And so in 1D, it's the constant function and the linear function. And if you think of functions on a sphere, maybe you expand them into YLMs, and then you know the eigenvalues of the Laplace operator on the sphere. They're minus L times L plus 1. L is a natural number. So for L equals 0, you have a 0 eigenvalue. This is why you can't solve it. So what you do is the usual thing. You add additional conditions to make it happen. Since this is a linear operator, people like to add additional linear conditions that keep things nice and simple. Everything is linear anyway. Yes?
You cage fix and introduce some funny pop-up codes that would then offer.
Okay. I don't know. How would gauging fix it?
I guess if we're not doing a path integral, it doesn't work, does it?
So I don't see how gauge fixing it works. But if you want to solve an elliptic equation on a sphere and you have 1, 0 eigenvalue, you need to invent one additional condition. So if there's one special point, you specify the solution there. Or you say, well, the integral over the solution of the sphere needs to be, and you choose something, anything, just something linear, and that would work. And of course, you can also do that here. And it turns out that if you have the Laplace operator here, and if you want to solve it in the discrete, then of course you have countable number of eigenfunctions, finite number. You can count how many are zero. If you do a finite difference discretization, you see that the number of zero eigenmodes is exactly the same as the number of boundary points. So if you apply boundary conditions, it works beautifully, both in the continuum, which we know already, and also in the discrete. So you have the Laplace operator, and you need to also apply boundary conditions in some way. And then you have U at the boundary, call it d omega or something fancy, equals, I don't know, let's set it to zero, do something simple here that works. And this means U at the boundary, that kind of projects U onto the boundary. It's a funny way of writing it, but it's also a linear operator. It just selects the boundary points. Now, for the wave equation, we had this efficient method where we could walk through the domain, solve it one by one. We know the solution at some points, pick one point, solve it there, pick another point, and so on. For the elliptic equations, that is not possible. In a way, the wave equation, of course, that's also a linear system that we are solving. And if you have a linear system and you can walk through it and solve it one by one, that means implicitly, although we didn't write it down, if we were to write down the wave equation boundary initial conditions into a big matrix, that matrix would be triangular. And then we can just walk from the bottom to the top and find the solution. And that's very convenient. That's also called an explicit method. It's very efficient for elliptic equations that's not possible. So what one has to do, one way is to explicitly construct that matrix and then just ask one of the linear solvers to give you a solution. And that's what we're going to do. We're going to take a 2D domain, we're going to discretize it using finite differences, exact same method as over there. We're going to specify boundary conditions at all outer boundaries. And then we're going to construct such a matrix. And then ask Julia to solve it, see what happens. And there's one thing that is a bit of a problem. Let's assume we want to have 100 points here. Say, and I equals, let's say 101, and J equals 101. This looks square. So you could think this has to do with the matrix that we're solving, but it isn't. This is the solution. This is U. U is the vector. I mean, it looks 2D, but for visualization, we already put that vector in 1D. So our vector has 10,000 points. this matrix has then how many points? 10,000 squared. So that wouldn't fit on your computer if we write it down as a big, as a dense matrix. Luckily, we don't need to, because if you calculate a finite differencing stencil, and each point depends only on the neighboring points, so each row of this matrix has many, many zeros and just 5 non-zeros. So that's going to be a sparse matrix. And you might have recalled me introducing sparse matrices. So right now we're going to construct a sparse matrix corresponding to that operator and ask a solver for that. And if it's a sparse matrix, then it is only 50,000 non-zero entries and is much better than 100 million. Okay, this was the plan for the remainder of the lecture. Is the plan clear to everybody? Okay, and again, want to keep it practical. I want to see how one actually does that. I don't assume that you all recall how to use sparse matrices. I'd even have skipped a bit of part of a lecture there. I'm going to continue to do that now. So let's move on. We have 35 minutes, right? Not 5 minutes.
Yes.
Good, good. Good, good. Good. Oh, in markdown mode, it doesn't do that. Just trying to be fancy here, so don't worry. That's the equation that we're solving. Good. Then we choose problem size. And to make it easy, and I equals 5, and j equals 5, dx equals 1 over. So I'm using I and j for x and y. And since the boundary condition is set to 0, if I set rho to 0 as well, the solution would be 0. This is quite boring, so I'm choosing a right-hand side rho that is non-zero. And it's going to be an array. It's going to be a 2D array. I'm going to start by setting it to 0. And then I'm going to pick one row where I'm going to set it to something non-zero. I'm just pick one point and set it to one there. And that corresponds to something like having kind of a Gaussian sitting there or something. Or maybe a Dirac delta, except that it's not infinitely large. Now, the big thing that one needs to do is actually construct the linear operator. That is the operator that we want to solve, the thing that we're going to use as a sparse matrix. And as expected, this is programming, it's going to be a bit tedious. So let's get started. So we're going to use linear algebra as a package because it's always convenient to have. And we're going to use the sparse arrays package. And we're going to define a sparse matrix. If you define a sparse matrix to do that is to create a list of all the non-zero entries. So let's do that. And internally, this list is passed as three arrays. The first array contains the row numbers, the second array, the column numbers, and the third array, the values that we have there. So it's not one array that consists of triples, but rather it's three independent arrays. Triples would be more elegant, but because this harks back to Fortran times where tuples didn't exist, it's going to be three separate arrays. I, rows, J, column, V, values. And we just define the arrays here. And every time we want to define a new element in the matrix that's non-zero, we just push it onto this array. And it doesn't matter what order is. And in the end, we're going to call a magic function that constructs the linear operator that does that. Let's start easy. Let's do the boundary conditions, right? So let's loop over. I don't like that. Well, let's just walk around all the boundaries, right? So now let's loop over the top boundary first. And we need to define the linear operator at the top boundary of the domain. So we're going to loop over all these points here, and we define the linear operator. And of course, here at the boundary of the domain, we are not in the interior, we are in the boundary. So the condition is that u should be equals to zero. I know it doesn't look much like a linear condition, but we need to pick this one matrix element and set it to one. It's kind of a bit of the identity matrix that we're doing here.
Can you broadcast a zero? Like to a whole row.
I could, but we're defining u and v, which are not 2D arrays. They're just holding all the indices, so it makes it a bit more complicated. You could. I'm going to introduce something like that. And then the row is 1. And the column is the same. And the value is 1. So the linear operator, what should we call it? Let's call it A. What this says, EI A comma A equals 1. OK, sorry. This is a bit of a trivial thing that we're doing, defining a boundary condition. So it might look confusing. But defining the on the boundary condition, of course, what we're just saying that u is equals to the boundary value. And now we're defining. So what we're going to do is be writing this in terms of a big matrix. And the condition is AX equals B. So we're defining this operator. In the interior, we're going to have to do the finer differencing. But on the boundary, we have to write kind of this condition as a matrix times something equals 0. And the matrix here, of course, is the identity matrix, because we're doing nothing special here. So it looks a bit confusing that I'm defining a matrix, and then the only thing I'm setting is the element I equals to 0. Maybe I should simplify it. We can solve an elliptic equation even in 1D and 2D. Maybe that would be easier, and there's less confusion there. Yeah, let me do that. Let me do that. I'm sorry. I didn't have the idea earlier, but it would be much easier. And if you solve it in 2D, 3D, and so on, it's exactly the same thing here. There was a T and you didn't tell me. Kids, kids, kids. Okay, waiting for the user interface. I'm deleting that line. I'm deleting that line. Rho is then just something 1D. You still need this. And then instead of top boundary, it's just the left boundary. And the right boundary condition is the same. Now we loop over the interior. We loop over all the points of our domain, which is now one-dimensional. Sorry, it's going to be easier when we're going to set up the finite differencing stencil. So we're not looping over all points, but only over some of the points. We're leaving out the boundary points that we already set.
You changed it to 1D, and what did you do with row? You had...
Row is just the 1D arena. It's just.
Is row 2 equal to 1?
I'm just choosing the right hand side. I'm choosing a non trivial function. I don't want it to be 0 everywhere. So pick one point and set it to 1 here. So the right hand side is now a function that is 0 everywhere and it has a peak at 1 point. And if you think that you're going to have a function where the solution has a high curvature there, so the solution is going to look like a triangle or something. You can choose. Maybe it would be easier to choose a different row to set it to 1 everywhere. Maybe that would be easier. Maybe that would be easier to set row 1 to row to 1 everywhere. Yeah, row is 1 everywhere. There you go. Now, A is a matrix. I'm going to sketch that here. So we're discretizing the operator dx squared u and rewriting it as a matrix. So we have a matrix A times u. So let's write it down. So these are the values of u. So we have ui minus 1 and ui and ui plus 1 and all the other values of u here. And we want to multiply this vector with the matrix here. And this row here should then be the second derivative of u at I. So the matrix entries here need to be the stencil coefficients 1, minus 2, and 1. The 1 over h squared in front. Does that make sense? A stencil is essentially a linear operator. And this finite differencing stencil here, if you write it in terms of a matrix, it looks like this. So the matrix that we have here, a matrix times a vector, should give the second derivative. And then we need to pick out these entries here. The row is always I. Column is I minus 1. This is the left stencil point. And then we have the center stencil point. And the right stencil point. Okay. This is a rather tedious way of writing what the entries of the matrix is. This defines the point or the stencil just defines the linear operator. Okay, I'm going to move on. And then we need to define also the right-hand side. Now we need to construct the linear operator. Okay, sorry, going to look at the documentation to see how that goes. Here, I, J, V, M, N. Okay. And look, that is how the matrix looks like. So you see the stencil, 1, minus 2, 1. And the first and the last row are just set to 1. This is the boundary condition. Now we also need to define the right-hand side. Which is the right-hand side vector. In the interior, the right-hand side vector is equal to rho. But on the boundaries, I need to set the right-hand side vector b to the boundary values. See how that looks like. And then let's solve it. Let's see how that whether that works. There's a solution here. And yeah, we can plot that. That went very quickly. Let me go and plot the solutions. You have an idea of how the solution looks like. And then we're going to go through all the code and explaining it again, step by step, what actually happens here. Because there are a couple of difficult steps. First, of course, what do you need to specify the elliptic equation, the linear operator, the distinction between the boundary, the interior, then how to convert the finite differencing stencil into actually a matrix, then how to actually define a sparse matrix that is different, how to set up the right-hand side and solving it, and so on. These are all not that complicated by themselves, but putting it together, that looks quite weird. But I want to plot that thing first. See what happens here. Feels as if I was doing the sketching on the blackboard myself, which is how people would have done it 20 or 30 years ago, and that would also have taken some time. Now, of course, I'm just waiting for the computer to do some plotting. Here is the solution. Wow. Ah, okay. And let's try again. And here's the solution. And you see, the solution is essentially a parabola. It's not surprising because we specified that rho is 1 everywhere. So the curvature of our solution is supposed to be the same everywhere. That gives us a parabola. We also specified that the boundary conditions be 0. The boundary points are set to 0. And if we now calculated the curvature of this parabola, the second derivative, we should find that this is 1. I can't see it, but oh no, we made a big error. I forgot the 1 over h squared factor. Okay, let's fix it. So we solved the wrong system. And there was an overall factor missing. The solution will not look very different, but you see that the values actually change because now the curvature actually 1. Before the curvature was 4 everywhere. Okay, let's go through that step by step. And I could just pick someone of you to explain what happens everywhere. So in the beginning, we choose the problem size, the number of points, and the grid spacing. That is fairly straightforward. There are no problems here. Then we choose the right-hand side. And here I choose the right-hand side to be one everywhere. That, of course, is boring. You want to make a suggestion for a more complicated right-hand side that looks interesting? The right-hand side, you see, does not need to be differentiable. You can set it to 0 and then to 1 everywhere. For example, you can solve the Poisson equation for a charge distribution of, what's it called? Compact sphere or something? Well, we can calculate the gravitational field around the planet, and we can assume the density of the Earth is constant, so the density is 0 on the outside and 1 in the interior, and we could do something like that and solve the equation. That would also give something interesting. Let's not do that here, because you want to go on further. Then we construct the linear operator, and we do that for a sparse matrix by just listing only all the matrix elements that are non-zero. And since most of them are zero, that is going to be efficient. And each matrix element is, of course, specified by the row I, by the column j, and by the value v. So we're going to have to define three arrays for that. That's the old school interface that is quite common. I is the row, j is the column, and v is the value. Let's ignore the boundaries because they look a bit weird, and instead look at the interior, how the Laplace operator looks like. The Laplace operator means to calculate the second derivative at one point, we need to look at three different points of the function. And that means that matrix has three entries, and the entries define how things are put together. That, of course, is just the matrix written in a different notation here. And so, say for the left stencil point, we define that we calculate the solution at point I, that's the row. We're looking at point I minus 1, that's the column. The solution at I depends on the function value at I minus 1, and the coefficient is 1 over h squared. And that's the same for the center point, there it's I and I, and the coefficient is minus 2 over h squared, and the right stencil point similarly. So we do this for all the interior points. On the interior points, we want to evaluate the second derivative, and we also do it at the boundary point, except at the boundary point, since we're just setting the function value, the respective linear operator is trivial there. It's just the matrix that is one in the respective column. So it looks like a bit of the identity matrix there. It's quite trivial, and with the complicated notation, maybe confusing. Now we also need to define the right-hand side. The right-hand side isn't just row, because we are solving the equation. Something equals rho only interior on the boundary. We set something to 0, so we need to construct this vector b in such a way that on the boundary, we choose the boundary values, and interior, we choose the rho values. So the first element is set to 0. This is just a Julia syntax for kind of concatenating arrays. We have one array element here, and then more elements from rho, and then the right element is the boundary value again that we specify. And you remember the backslash operator for solving the system? Sorry, I skipped off this step here, actually constructing the sparse matrix. The sparse arrays package has a function called sparse, and you pass in ijv that defines the non-zero elements and the size of the matrix, ni times ni. And this is how the operator looks like. And when we solve it and plot it, the solution looks like that. Next, I'm going to increase the number of points and do the same thing again. And then we could look at maybe more interesting right-hand sides. So when you output a sparse matrix in Julia, and the sparse matrix is too large, it just gives you the non-zero pattern. It uses the Unicode Braille characters to give you dots and shows you how that looks like. you look, the first element is, there's just one element in the first row, in the last row, and in the other rows, there are three non-zero elements that are kind of sitting close to the diagonal, exactly what we expected. Here's the right-hand side vector, looks pretty boring. Then we solve the system. That is pretty fast, although the matrix is now quite large. And then we plot it, and the function looks essentially the same as before. And I'm going to choose a different right-hand side. I know I shouldn't modify the notebook, but I'm just going to modify it here. Row. Where is it? This value here. This operator here, kind of the double dot with the minus sign in between, this is called diff. Spelled like this, it's an integer division that rounds down. So this means if you use the regular division, you'd get a floating point number, it doesn't work. So I'm just choosing 10, actually 11 points where I set things to be non-zero, everything else at zero. And then let's plot it and see what the solution is. There you go. And that's as you expect. The curvature of the solution is zero. In the large range of points where we said that the right-hand side is zero, that's what you specify in the elliptic equation, you specify the curvature. And then the center, the curvature is one. So it's nicely rounded, the parabola that smoothly fits together.
What point did you set non-zero in your new row?
From ni over 2 to ni over 2 plus 10. Yeah, I'm going to write it nicer with parentheses. Maybe that makes it easier to see. And the thing that I want to drive home again is that the matrix is really, really large. I mean, here not yet, although here the matrix is already 50 by 50, which is non-trivial. And if you go to 2D or higher dimensions, the matrix, of course, quickly becomes insanely large, and the nonsense with sparse matrices and all the complexity with defining the operator then becomes really necessary. I initially planned this lecture to take the whole time, not just the half time with the wave equation, and then I would have had time to go through the additional technical complexity of handling things in 2D. And of course, in 2D, the stencil is twice as large and so on and so forth. It's a bit more complicated. Also, if you put things into a sparse matrix, you have rows and columns. And if you have these grid points here, they are not nicely laid out in a row and a column. Rather, you need to put this into a vector. So you need to find one way to number these grid points when assign these grid points, and that's complicated because this grid point here is then, for example, I plus 50 times j and so on and so forth. It's just laying out the 2D grid points into 1D. If you've done it before, it's always the same with a stride and an offset. If you haven't seen it before, it takes another 10 minutes to explain, which fortunately I didn't have. But if you do that, you can put it into a sparse matrix and it works just fine, even in 3D. And of course, you can use a higher accuracy as well if you use higher order stencils.
Would you be able to scroll down to the boundary conditions?
Yes. I did the boundary conditions first because I thought that would be easier.
Could you go down to the next function or the next loop?
So here I specify the matrix for the boundary condition, which is just a bit of the identity matrix. And further down here, I specify the boundary values, which end up on the right-hand side. It's weird that things get split out into A and B that way. It doesn't make it easier.
Could you scroll up to the for loop?
The part and bottom? It doesn't scroll at the moment. Where do you want to go?
Yes.
And at an even higher level, all that we did, we took the equation that we had, the elliptic equation plus the boundary conditions, we wrote it as a linear system, and we used the black box linear solver to get the solution. Do you have other questions on that?
Could you just scroll down to where you plotted?
Okay. You can have the notebook in 10 minutes as soon as Emily sends it to you.
Something's not working.
It's not working for you?
Please. It's just a small thing that I'm not getting, so I'm sure I could just...
Yeah, I mean, setting up the linear operator, it's tedious, it's easy to get the indexing wrong there somewhere. Other methods that people use for elliptic equations are not finite differences, but rather spectral methods. Where you expand a function into basis functions, and then construct an operator based on that. And the advantage is, this is much more accurate if you know that your solution is nice and analytic, it doesn't have any step function. Okay, that's that then. Then I will see you again for one more tutorial where I want you to actually do these things yourself, basically repeat what I showed here in the lecture, make sure that you understood it, that it works for you, and I want you to apply a convergence test to it, which is similar to what we did, except we did it in a simple way, where we just calculated a derivative of a sine function or something more fancy. Now I want you to apply it to a numerical solution where you actually solve the PDE. I'm going to leave it up to you whether you want to do it for a hyperbolic and an elliptic PDE. Hyperbolic. Okay, see you Friday.